You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our fall fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Poland shoots down Russian drones. The U.S. and China trade representatives meet. And human trafficking for scamming operations is big business in Myanmar. First, Poland shoots down Russian drones. For the first time in the Ukraine war, a NATO ally, Poland, has fired a shot. Poland's Air Force shot down several Russian drones that crossed as far as 300 miles into Polish territory across from western Ukraine. Poland called the incident a deliberate act of aggression. Its response reportedly had NATO's full consent. Poland's foreign minister had some advice for Trump. He said in a PBS interview, quote, "I think it's high time that President Trump should see that Putin is mocking him. Instead of a ceasefire that was supposed to happen before the Alaska summit and serious peace talks, Putin is sending more and more drones, first at Ukraine and now at NATO," unquote. Romania also scrambled jets when Russian drones strayed into its airspace. But so far, Trump has said only that the Russian attack, quote unquote, might be a mistake, a comment the Poles immediately corrected. He claims he has taken action against Russia, high tariffs on India in response to India's purchases of Russian oil, but that hardly qualifies as sanctions. Consider that another customer for Russian oil is Hungary, and Trump's friend Viktor Orban. No sanctions on him. The Economist's defense correspondent, Shashank Joshi, writes that, quote, "The interceptors fired by NATO jets and ground-based air defenses are both expensive and scarce. The alliance, unlike Ukraine, currently has few means of low-cost interception. Although 19 drones are not a big problem, hundreds would be," unquote. So there's a real problem if Russia chooses to significantly increase its drone probes. NATO has launched Eastern Sentry, an operation to beef up joint monitoring and patrols. Details are vague. But notably, writes Joshi, quote, "there has been no discussion of shooting down drones over Ukraine before they enter NATO airspace." 2 days ago, however, Poland's foreign minister called for NATO to create a no-fly zone over Ukraine to protect against drone attacks. And a spokesman for the Kremlin said NATO and Russia are de facto at war. Next, U.S. and Chinese trade representatives meet. Following a fourth round of trade talks in Madrid, a framework agreement was reached with China on the future of TikTok. Congressional legislation requires that TikTok, because of debatable security reasons, either find an American owner or be banned from the U.S. Finding an owner has taken President Trump many months. The agreement with China kicks the can down the road as Trump seeks out a non-Chinese owner. Trade talks remain complicated and adversarial. Two major issues at the moment are China's refusal to buy U.S. soybeans, which have American farmers reeling, since a significant portion of their soybean crop normally goes to China. The other issue is NVIDIA, the premier U.S. chip manufacturer. China's state regulating agency is charging that NVIDIA violated monopoly laws by acquiring a firm that would give the company too much power. Jensen Huang, NVIDIA's chief executive, sees the ability to do business with China as crucial to the company's efforts to keep its position as the leading maker of AI chips. This antitrust investigation by the Chinese comes as the U.S. has added 23 Chinese companies to the list of those that are barred from purchasing U.S. technology, again for national security reasons. Thus, we have another tit-for-tat situation that has regularly marred U.S.-China trade talks and may lead to another round of tariff increases by both sides. At present, the U.S. tariff rate on Chinese goods is 30%, China's 10% on U.S. imports. Overall, China's exports to the U.S. have shrunk about 15% over the past year, but its worldwide exports have boomed. China's likely to have a trade surplus that will exceed last year's $1 trillion, mainly due to large trade surpluses with all developing country regions, as well as electric vehicle sales in Europe. Human trafficking for scamming operations is big business in Myanmar. Crime syndicates and the ruling Myanmar military have joined forces to create a gigantic online scamming operation that may involve as many as 100,000 people who have been trafficked on the pretense of being offered legitimate jobs. 27 scam centers have been built along the border between Myanmar and Thailand, each looking from the outside like a modern industrial city complete with apartments and high-rises. The Guardian reports that, quote, drone images and new research reveal that the number of such centers operating along the Thai-Myanmar border has more than doubled since Myanmar's military seized power in 2021, with construction continuing to this day, unquote. The scam centers are heavily fortified, but one rescue operation did free 7,000 workers. Information on the violence done to workers who try to resist has also come from the occasional escapee. The Myanmar military support of these centers is the basic problem. As The Guardian reports, Myanmar's military junta has allowed the spread of scam centers inside the country, as these criminal enterprises have become an essential part of the country's conflict economy since the coup, helping it rise to the top of the global list of countries harboring organized crime. In other news, Chinese cyber attacks have become an international issue. Chinese government-backed hacking operations have taken on new dimensions. Experts from several Western countries consider a cyber attack by a group known as Salt Typhoon to be China's most ambitious yet. It targeted more than 80 countries and may have stolen information from nearly every American, officials said. They see it as evidence that China's capabilities rival those of the United States and its allies. British and American officials have described the attack as unrestrained and indiscriminate. In a highly unusual joint statement, these officials, along with others from Canada, Finland, Germany, Italy, Japan, and Spain, issued a name and shame effort directed at the Chinese government. They named three Chinese technology companies as providing, quote, cyber-related products and services to China's intelligence services, including multiple units in the People's Liberation Army and Ministry of State Security. The data stolen through this activity against foreign telecommunications and internet service providers, as well as intrusions in the lodging and transportation sectors, ultimately can provide Chinese intelligence services with the capability to identify and track their targets' communications and movements around the world. Venezuelan boats come under U.S. attack. The Trump administration has twice attacked Venezuelan boats that allegedly were carrying drugs, even though the boats turned around from supposedly heading to the U.S. In all, 14 people have been killed in the attacks. Normal interdiction of suspected drug smugglers would have required that the boat be stopped and its contents searched. I think it's fair to conclude that the orders to attack the boats were made to send three messages. First, that drug smuggling is now a national security issue. Next, that the use of force in Latin America, with Venezuela the first possible target, is now U.S. policy. And third, that we should get used to seeing the military engaged in policing duties, offshore and onshore. Free Jimmy Lai. Jimmy Lai is the pro-democracy owner of the Hong Kong newspaper Apple Daily, which the Chinese authorities have shut down. He has been in solitary confinement for nearly 5 years, since being convicted of sedition and other anti-state crimes under China's notorious national security law, imposed on Hong Kong in 2022. Lai, who suffers from diabetes and is reported to be in very bad health, was tried a year ago, but the Chinese authorities have yet to sentence him. The British government has done little to seek Lai's release on health grounds. President Trump has repeatedly said he will press Xi Jinping to release Lai, who holds British citizenship. But so far as we know, Trump has not brought the matter up with Xi. Next, protesters in Indonesia and Nepal, led by young people, fight corruption and inequality. Indonesia's government had promised 8% economic growth and generous welfare policies, but that has not been enough to satisfy the country's poor. Protesters, many led by a student union, are demanding lower defense spending to pay for food security and an end to certain politicians' privileges. The protest began when a food delivery man was killed. People elsewhere in Southeast Asia are supporting the protests by giving food to delivery men. President Prabowo Subianto has answered the protests with a crackdown, but that has not stopped the protests, which so far have led to the deaths of about a dozen people and thousands arrested. In Nepal, mass protests, largely consisting of young people, have led to the resignation of the prime minister and other officials. The protests have turned violent, with politicians' homes attacked and grenades thrown at government buildings. The prime minister's home was set afire. Government forces have fired on crowds, killing at least 19. Much as in Indonesia, this so-called Gen Z protest is in response to limited economic opportunity, social inequality, official corruption, and censoring of social media. Last week, a new prime minister with a reputation for fighting corruption was appointed. The French government collapses. For the second time in a year, the French government has collapsed with the forced resignation of its prime minister, François Bayrou. The parliament voted no confidence in him, again leaving President Emmanuel Macron unable to pass a budget resolution to deal with France's huge deficit, which is about 6% of GDP. Macron's tenure ends in 2027. Rather than call early elections, Macron chose to appoint yet another prime minister, Sébastien Lecornu. Lecornu had been defense minister for the past 3 years and was known for increasing French military spending. He said, quote, "We are going to have to change, be more creative and serious in our way of working with the opposition," unquote. Good idea, and good luck in realizing it in France's deeply divided political system. The two-state idea in the Middle East is not dead. The United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly voted to endorse a declaration outlining, quote, "tangible, time-bound, and irreversible steps toward a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians ahead of a meeting of world leaders." That meeting will take place September 22nd. Britain, France, Canada, Australia, and Belgium are expected to formally recognize a Palestinian state at the meeting. The General Assembly declaration condemns both the Hamas attack of October 2023 and Israel's inhumane policies in Gaza. Once again, the U.S. and Israel voted against the declaration, whereas all the Gulf Arab states voted for it, even though it called for the disarming of Hamas. The Environmental Protection Agency will no longer require pollution reporting. In keeping with its effort to deny climate change and abolish regulation of pollution, the Environmental Protection Agency has proposed ending reporting requirements for coal-powered plants, oil refineries, and around 8,000 other major sources of greenhouse gases. The EPA director, Lee Zeldin, a zealous guardian of polluters, said the proposal will, quote, "unleash U.S. energy dominance and eliminate bureaucratic red tape." What the proposal actually will do is further undermine U.S. efforts at the international and local levels to fight climate change. All that will remain of emissions reporting is from oil and gas pipelines. One wonders when the EPA itself will be abolished, since it has clearly become an agency for environmental destruction, not protection. Finally, this update from Brazil. The former president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, has been convicted and sentenced to over 20 years in jail for attempting a coup in 2022 following his election defeat. The chief judge in the case defied Trump's threats and sanctions. Following the verdict, Secretary of State Marco Rubio repeated Trump's threats in another brazen intervention in Brazilian affairs. Another round of U.S. tariff increases seems likely. Defenders of the sentencing remind Americans that Brazil's democracy has jailed a former president for the same crime that Trump committed but escaped punishment. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News in Depth. where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Dave Johnson. I'm here with Douglas Soy, founder of Portland Underground Grad School, to talk about what PUGS is all about. Welcome to the show. How did PUGS come into being?
Yeah, I founded PUGS back in 2015 when I essentially just created the thing I wanted in life, which was school for everyday life. Like, you know, I'm like one of those people, like lifelong learners who, like, every year I'd want to go back to grad school. Like, one year it'd be like, oh, I want to get a degree in behavioral economics. And then I researched schools and it didn't make sense. It was too expensive. I didn't want to disrupt my life. And the next year it'd be like, I want a degree in Chinese philosophy. And realized it's way too expensive and it didn't make any sense, right? And so what I realized is I wanted to keep on learning and growing, but I didn't want to pay for grad school, right? So back in 2015, I just created a way for lifelong learners to keep on going to school for the rest of their lives.
So who comes to PUGS?
It is, the way I like to think about it, it is people who are interesting and interested. There are people who, like, you know, want to be in community. And so one of the things I always say is PUGS is half learning and is half community. And I think it's actually become more important now. I ran PUGS for 4 years, from 2015 to the 2018. And I think I was really focused on learning. I just wanted to learn everything. And I went to all the classes. And I met all sorts of wonderful people. And we're restarting PUGS now. And what I realized just in this current moment, it feels like the connection and the community are just as or more important than learning.
So I just heard you say that you developed PUGS.
Yeah.
You go to the classes, but you also teach the classes too. So this is really interactive. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the keys is almost all the courses are live in person. They're in community centers all around the city. And the whole idea is that, you know, I don't know if about you, Dave, but, you know, a good number of my closest friends in life I made when I was in school. You know, it's that third place. You're interacting about something that is interesting to you and the other person. So the idea of, like, being live and in person is a key part of this. So, like, the connection, the community, the dialogue, all the classrooms are basically set up in circles. One of the major rules we have for instructors is that you should only be talking about half the time. The point is to facilitate dialogue. You know, everyone's an adult there. Everyone has a rich set of experiences and skills that they're bringing into the classroom. So we want to be sharing all that. So the sharing of knowledge with each other is important part of the pedagogy.
So my question was, part of this was, you know, what do these students have in common? You've given me a lot of things already about how they are. What other things come to mind for you?
I think they're people who just generally want to grow in their lives. They're just like, I think there's something that they want to learn or some way that they want to change as people. Some interest that they have that, you know, you can explore on the internet, but, you know, sitting at home reading about a thing on Reddit or like getting a book out of the library is not the same thing as actually interacting with someone. And especially when you have an instructor who's super knowledgeable about the topic. So it's people who want to connect, people who want to learn, people who kind of find the value of having an intellectual community.
This flows naturally into the next question here. What courses do you teach?
We are rebooting PUGS, and there are 5 classes this fall, and I'm teaching 2 of them. On Mondays, one of our most popular courses is being held, Rewilding 101 with Peter Michael Bauer, and he's amazing. It's sort of about pre-civilization and what we can learn about and what we could, what ideally we'd like to return to, what sort of values and principles pre-civilization had. On Tuesday nights is Sex Ed for Adults with Stella Harris, and she's amazing. She's a sex educator here in Portland, and she'll be talking about, like, what are the things that we didn't learn as kids in about sex and, you know, things like anatomy. But, you know, I remember when I was a kid, what I learned about sex was about 2 things, disease and pregnancy, and how to avoid both. And Stella wants to reclaim the idea of sex as pleasure, and how do we bring that sex as pleasure and consent. You know, how do we bring that together as adults? And then on Wednesday nights, I am teaching a class called Finding the Great Work of Your Life. And it's based on a book by the education director of Kripalu, which is a meditation center on the East Coast. And he is sort of taking the Bhagavad Gita, which is an ancient Hindu text, and helping people apply it to modern day life. You know, people who, especially in this moment of time in history, like, what are we supposed to be doing with our lives? How do we be contributing to society? Like, what impact can I make? How do I find clarity with all these things happening? So that's the course I'm doing on Wednesdays. In November, there is a course called Tree Allyship with Melissa Melko, which is an amazing course about, like, how do you actually find, you know, solidarity and allyship with the natural world. And then I'll be teaching a course called Financial Freedom.
So is there much homework?
There's always homework.
Of course there is.
Of course. There's reading and there's homework. And I think that's part of the pleasure. Like, when you enter class, everyone's done the homework. So you can have a dialogue that's much richer than if people just showed up spouting opinions.
As the director, as a student, as an instructor, what do you get out of it personally?
I mean, I have met so many people through PUGS. I mean, like, you know, like, again, interesting and interested people. You know, like, I've met so many wonderful people, and I've learned so many things, right? And because I was the founder of PUGS, I went to every class, so I learned things that I never would have chosen. And I think people who get the most out of it are people who are like, oh, I don't know anything about this topic, but I'm willing to dive in. And that's where your boundaries really, really expand.
What do your students say about PUGS? Having been part of the program, what do they say about you?
You know, once we put out the fact that we're coming back, I think people were super excited because, I mean, you know, what do you do on a Tuesday night, right? Like, generally, PUGS is a better thing to do on a Tuesday night than almost anything, right? Like, there's an excitement of going back to class. There's no grades, right? Like, you're not being evaluated. So it's just a pure joy of learning, and people are super excited for that to happen again.
So why is this work important?
Yeah, this work is important because, you know, I think we all have inherent belief that learning is a right, right? It's a right, it's a desire, and right now there's no institution that allows people to keep on learning for the rest of their lives, right? Other than universities, but the educational industrial complex puts all sorts of barriers up, both financial and, I don't know, like, you know, it's very selective, right? So you have to pay money, you have to apply, and to me, that is the opposite of education being a right. And so, like, I believe we live in a period of time where you have to keep on learning for the rest of your life, and we have to find places and ways for us to do this.
Have you had a student who's come up with curriculum down the road after having been a student?
That's an interesting question, Dave, because one of the rules at PUGS is, and any number of people want to teach at PUGS because it's super fun. Like, from the instructor side, right, you have a lot of people who are super educated, want to share their knowledge, and, you know, the university system, you're either like a very poorly paid adjunct, and you're teaching things you don't actually want to teach. Mm-hmm. And then you have PUGS here where you get to teach exactly what you want to teach. And there are no grades, and there's no bureaucracy between you and the student. So the funny rule is, because we have so many people that want to teach at PUGS, the rule is you can't teach a class until you take a class, and that's part of joining the community. So every person who has taught a course at PUGS was first a student.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about PUGS, what's the best way that they can do that?
We have a website, which is PUGSPDX, PUGSPDX, or you can just Google Portland Underground Grad School, and you can look at the tab that says Fall 2025, and you can see all our cool courses. You can learn all the things there is to know, the FAQs about PUGS. Oh, one thing I should mention, Dave, is that we have essentially a pricing plan that fits everyone. The tuition is based on income. And so, again, part of the idea is if education is right, everyone has to be able to come in.
So there's a sliding scale.
Yeah, there is. There are tiers, and you just
I understand.
And I mean, there's no income verification. You just choose the tier that you want to come in at.
How did you first learn about Pugs?
Douglas reached out to me. He's the founder of Pugs, reached out to me, and I honestly don't remember how he initially heard about me, but, you know, Portland operates like kind of a small town, so he'd heard about me and my other sex education work and reached out to see if I might be interested in developing a course that would be a good fit for Pugs.
Here's a technical question about Pugs itself here. How does the school divide its school year?
So it's not, you know, a typical, you know, graduate school style. There aren't sort of semesters in quite the same way. Most of the courses, including mine, are four-week courses. So that's clearly not, you know, a typical semester or quarter system. But you will see that there is a whole new fall lineup coming up starting in October with lots of other great courses in addition to mine. But the four-week format works really well. Most of the workshops that I teach end up being, you know, a one-off workshop, 90 minutes or 2 hours for a lot of the places that I teach. So getting to have 4 weeks lets me get a lot deeper than I usually can. And having the same group of students over the course of 4 weeks also means that they can go a little bit deeper because, of course, these topics, you know, it's kind of sensitive and kind of vulnerable. Even if you're learning it academically, folks aren't used to having these conversations. So having the same group of folks together over the course of 4 weeks means that, you know, by the end of that, they're a little bit more comfortable asking questions. But again, because it's 4 weeks, while that is more in-depth than I usually get to go, it's also less of a time commitment for folks than, say, a standard, you know, academic semester might be. So it's sort of a perfect combination of letting instructors go a little bit deeper, but still recognizing that a lot of folks that want to take these courses couldn't necessarily commit to a full, you know, semester of academic courses.
I follow you. So this really begs the next question. What courses or course will you teach this coming term or
well,
this
so the
coming
course
session?
That I am teaching coming up this October for Pugs and that I've taught twice before for them is called Sex Ed for Adults, Things You Should Have Learned in School. And so this basically brings up questions like, what if we had taught people that sex was supposed to be about pleasure? What if we talked about different relationship structures, different relationship styles? It talks about, you know, sexual identities and queer sex ed. It talks a little bit about kink and BDSM. It is sort of a broad overview of everything from anatomy to communication to relationships to sort of some of the more advanced or niche sex ed topics. So each week we dive a little bit deeper into a particular topic. And again, because it's a multi-week course, I am able to assign homework, which is not having people write essays, but is often something like read this article in advance so we can discuss it, which is a lot of fun for me as an instructor as well.
Who are your students?
You know, it's a broad range of folks. I mean, as the title says, it's all adults. So, you know, everyone is at least 18. But typically folks are older than that as well. I've done three courses for Pugs. I've run Sex Ed for Adults twice, and I did a four-week course specifically on kink and BDSM. And I would say most of the students were, you know, in their 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, adults who are curious to go a little bit deeper into these topics. Some folks are simply curious for their own lives, and some folks are curious for their work. I get, you know, therapists, other folks in the, you know, mental health or health field who want to be able to, you know, have better interactions with their clients, with their patients, and get some of that, you know, information to help inform their work. So it's really a broad range of folks.
What do you personally get out of instructing at Pugs?
I mean, I sort of shifted into this career, you know, broadly in sex and kink education, kind of by accident. And it's just really amazing to be able to be in the room with folks when they are having some kind of an aha moment, when they are realizing that they're not the only person who has a particular interest or a particular feeling, when they realize that something that their body is doing is okay, is natural, is normal. I mean, normal is really such a useless word when it comes to bodies because we're all so different. But nobody wants to think that they are the only one of anything. And because we don't talk about these topics, a lot of folks do feel alone. So being able to talk about these things and just normalize everything from different forms of interests, different feelings, that just feels really powerful to be able to be part of that for people and sort of help people along on their exploration journeys.
So, Stella, what do your students say about your classes?
You know, I mean, the positive feedback definitely is one of the things that, that keeps educators going. And, you know, I love hearing from folks that they learned something they had never thought about before. Or, you know, as I said, folks who realize that that they are okay, that they aren't alone. You know, I even had a class once where somebody ended up crying in class when they, you know, saw something that I had shown because they realized that, yeah, that they were normal, that they were okay. So that, yeah, that is some of the really powerful stuff I hear that, that keeps me doing this work.
Why is this work important?
I think that this work is important because I think that, you know, sexual wellness, sexual well-being, being in healthy relationships is absolutely essential to somebody's